The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
This blood brothering between you, Prince Midalis, and you, Chieftain Brunhilde, will be the first in over a decade. You are not to harm the Shaggoth in no way, not even at the cost of your own life. Not that you could bring harm to the great beast anyway. Not even if you brought fine weapons in there with you. This is a test of your courage, not your warrior skills, and a test of your trust in each other. If either of you fails, then you both will surely die, and horribly. Are you prepared to begin?
What are you about, Elf? Are you going to tell me or not?
You take care, Bradwarden. On the South Road, I heard rumors of the Rosy Plague.
Oh, by the demons, you say?
I know not if there's any truth to those words. More likely, they were the utterances of a gossiping fool and nothing more. But I can ill afford to take the chance, any chance, of bringing the plague back to my people. Know that if the land becomes ill with plague, the Tuelalfar will secure our borders, and none will leave for many years. Farewell.
It is the plague! It is confirmed, my king! The Rosy Plague! What are we to do?
What can we do? Lock our doors fast and tight.
Oh, but where are you then? You've not been out of your walls in days! In weeks! Are you just to sit in there and let us all die then? Are you just to stand on your walls and shoot us dead if we come too close? And you're calling yourself the Folk of God? But you're just a pack of scared dogs, you are!
Join with us before all the world has fallen into darkness. Help us put the church aright and thus end the misery of the plague.
You believe the plague to be a punishment from God?
On those who have forsaken the truth.
Absurd.
Obvious. I see it, and they see it. We know the truth, and we know the source, and no edicts from Father Abbot Agrangere will sway us from that path.
You risk the wrath of Father Abbot Agrangere and all the masters of St. Mirabel.
And you, Brother Glendonhawk, risk the wrath of Marcalo de Unaro. Which of us, then, do you believe in the worst situation?
You have gone mad.
As much has been said of many prophets. If you try to stop us, you may prove victorious, but I warn you that I will come for your throat first and foremost.
Experience the latest chapter of the Demon Wars saga in graphic audio. Don't miss Mortalis Part 2. Available now.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, Nanette Savard, Ren Casey, Eric Messner, Christopher Graybill, M.B. Van Dorn, Stephen Carpenter, Thomas Penny, Johan Detweiler, David Coyne, Tom Simpson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Sonny Lasky, and Colleen Delaney. Survivalist number 20, Firestorm.
(Clears throat)
The grazing gunshot wound across John Rourke's back stung more than hurt. He knew from his medical training that the numbness setting in at the center of his back was merely the body's defense mechanism against pain. And he was cold, a combination of weather conditions and possibly shock. If it were shock setting in, John did what he could to minimize it. He pulled up the hood of his parka and secured it. He closed his coat all the way and kept his gloves on. Finally, he moved slowly, trying not to tax his strength, saving his body's resources. Beyond those measures, there was no time after turning back the Soviet attack against Eden Base for John to treat the wound. 6 or 7 of the elite corpsmen escaped the battlefield and fled into miles of the long, narrow band of dense evergreen woods that ranged north towards the mountains like a scar. A frozen creek bed ran its length, bisecting the woods. Rourke's fists were tight on his M16. His 5 handguns were reloaded and holstered. John followed the fast-filling footprints in the snow. 6 or 7 sets of male footprints, so jumbled he could not discern the exact number. Had it been only these, he would have let the men go. German aircraft aplenty were available for an aerial search that would eventually find them, despite the poor visibility from the falling snow and the coming night. Eventually was the key word, however. There was a complication adding urgency to the chase, an extra set of footprints, a woman's. One of the women of the Eden-based defenders left her defensive position by the breach in the wall to join Rourke in the counterattack. She was not accounted for. Nobody on the battlefield or listed among the many wounded at the bomb-damaged field hospital. Her name was Maritza Zeiss, one of the West German members of the International Astronaut Corps that comprised Eden-based personnel. The tread pattern of the woman's boot prints matched that of the boots worn by Eden personnel. It was a pattern distinctly different than the tread pattern of the Soviet footgear. A German helicopter gunship eased into a landing near the re-entry point at the line the woods made in the snow-packed plain leading toward Eden Base and the road that served as the Eden Project landing field. Rourke could see the ruined and, at least temporarily abandoned, German base in the distance. Rourke stopped there. The Midwake submarine commander, Captain Jason Darkwood, shivered beside him.
I'm used to more controlled climate conditions, Doctor. Forgive the noise of my chattering teeth.
It's merely a natural body defense. Your body is trying to generate heat through motion. My teeth are chattering a little bit, too.
Rourke watched the helicopter more intently now as his friend Paul Rubinstein exited, running toward them out of the swirl of artificial blizzard created by the downdraft of the whirring rotor blades.
You should be getting that wound treated, John!
Paul jogged toward them, jockeying his German MP-40 submachine gun and his M16 back on their slings so he could close his coat.
News travels fast!
Paul smiled. A second later, the smile vanished behind the black-knit toque he pulled over his head and face.
Well, I spoke with Elaine Halverson on the radio. She told me what you guys were up to out here. Sam Aldridge sent Lieutenant St. James's platoon by chopper a few miles farther north. Michael's with them. Aldridge figured to cut the elite corpsmen off.
Good. We'll have to keep in radio contact so we don't wind up shooting each other. It'll be dark soon. Or I should say, darker.
The weather had been deteriorating, if that were possible, throughout the day, conditions going from annoying to intolerable to dangerous. With the conventional avionics of 5 centuries ago, no helicopter would have dared fly.
Let's treat your wound aboard the gunship, all right? We'll make better time because of it in the long run.
John Rourke just looked at his friend.
What, suddenly you're the doctor?
Yeah, you know what makes sense.
We do it fast.
Rourke headed toward the black German gunship. Akira Kuranami looked as if he were about to pass out from exhaustion. He knelt beside Sarah, where she sat with her back to the wall. Fewer than 12 feet from her lay the body of the man she shot, as he was about to shoot Akira Kuranami in the back. Colonel Mann and Commander Dodd stood on opposite sides of the body. Sarah looked at the Trapper Scorpion 45 still in her hand, the slide locked back, open over the empty magazine. She shot the man until the gun was fired out. Since the night of the war, she killed many people in defense of herself or defense of others. But there was something very different, scarily unnerving about this. The man she killed was clearly about to cold-bloodedly murder Akira. Why? Sarah Rourke turned her thoughts with some difficulty toward the conversation between Colonel Mann and Commander Dodd.
It could be that she was mistaken. After all, Mrs. Rourke is under considerable strain. She's pregnant and...
Commander, if Frau Rourke indicated that she shot this man, Damian Rausch, an escaped Nazi criminal, because he was attempting to murder Lieutenant Kuranami, then that is exactly the way that it happened.
You keep saying he's a Nazi of some kind, but can you be sure? I mean, did you memorize the face of every one of the men in the Nazi party after it was deposed?
There were two men at the hierarchy of the Leaders' Party elite. They were brothers. This man, Damian Rausch, and Friedrich Rausch, were the very elite of those elite. You have, no doubt, heard of the SS.
That was 500 years ago, Colonel.
But the pattern of organization within the Nazi Party that dominated my nation until Dr. Rourke assisted us in at last attaining freedom was identical to that of the Nazi era in the 1930s and 1940s in old Germany. The SS were the leader's political police and eternal stalwarts.
Mann looked from Commander Dodd to Sarah. Sarah's eyes met his.
The brothers Rausch were the most vile and despicable of the leader's minions. They would never surrender their beliefs in the ultimate triumph of National Socialism. And if Friedrich Rausch still lives, he will never surrender the desire to kill Frau Rourke for killing his brother.
It was cold there by the wall, the snow hard driven on the wind. Paul was right, of course. The alternating stinging and numbness was gone once John got his wound cleaned and treated. Taking a fresh parka from the gunship helped, too. A parka without the added ventilation made by the rifle bullet helped against the cold nearly as much as the knowledge that the wound was even less serious than John suspected. With Paul Rubinstein and Jason Darkwood flanking him, all three with their weapons at the ready, they moved through the woods. As Rourke feared, the footprints were harder to follow because they were harder to see. The blowing snow filled them fast. But here and there, where one of the tall pines broke the wind, there was sign. The sparsely scattered footprints followed the line of the frozen creek. It was rocky here, as if the creek bed were a gouge and the material moved aside for its creation had been strewn about haphazardly to either side. Rourke's strength was returning as he got his second wind, beyond fatigue. They lost the trail for nearly a quarter mile. John was just about to concede that the fleeing KGB elite corpsmen and their hostage went deeper into the woods, leaving the course of the creek bed. But then, as he shifted his flashlight right, Rourke saw something in the high, smooth rocks near the center of the creek bed. It was clearly a footprint.
Paul! Give me a hand down there!
You see something?
I think it's a track! There in the cleft in the rock! Empty your M16, Paul!
John Rourke checked his M16's condition of readiness. He clicked it on safe for the climb down. He moved toward the embankment. Jason Darkwood pulled his radio headset microphone into place.
This is Captain Darkwood calling scouting party. Come in. Over.
Rourke didn't wait to have the transmission relayed to him. He moved down over the ice-coated rocks of the creek bank. Paul Rubinstein wedged above him, held an emptied M16 by the buttstock as Rourke edged down, moving his hands along the front handguard, then down along the barrel toward the flash deflector. The footing was dangerous, uncertain. Rourke moved slowly and cautiously. To break or twist an ankle now would benefit no one. He could faintly hear Darkwood.
We're proceeding as planned, Lieutenant. What's your status? Over.
There was nothing for it but to drop the remaining 3 feet to the level of the creek, unless he wanted to climb back up and start down again with a rope. Rourke jumped, coming down in a crouch on the ice-coated dirt and gravel. He slipped, caught himself on both hands. His rifle buttstock banged against a rock. Cautiously, Rourke moved to a standing position. With the aid of the flashlight, he scanned the stream bed, trying to place the cleft of rock he had seen from above from this different perspective. He had it. Slowly, he walked out onto the frozen ripples of the creek. With his M16, still on safe, in his left hand, Rourke tapped gently against the surface of the ice with its muzzle, like a blind man. He stopped walking and mused simultaneously as his eyes focused on the imprint in the snow-filled niche in the rocks under the beam of his flashlight. It was a deep handprint that clearly belonged to a woman. Rourke turned to Paul up on the bank of the creek.
This is where they crossed the stream. Come on.
The snow fell lighter here in the tall pines, but the boughs above him looked weighted almost to the breaking point. Occasionally, a bough would partially collapse under the weight, and snow by the bucketful fell, covering Rourke. John circled a small clearing clockwise. Paul circled it counterclockwise. Rourke rolled back the storm sleeve of his parka and cupped his right hand around the lens of the flashlight, nearly covering it as he turned his back toward the far side of the clearing. The Rolex on his wrist confirmed 5 minutes had passed. A radio communication from Lieutenant St. James only moments before confirmed what Rourke's tracking showed. The elite corpsmen were tiring, slowing. From a vantage point among high rocks nearly a mile away, using sophisticated light-gathering binoculars, Lieutenant St. James's Marines spotted the group. 8 people in all translated to 7 elite corpsmen and their female hostage. They had stopped to rest. As Rourke switched off the beam of his flashlight and turned around, Jason Darkwood entered the edge of the clearing, half its length behind Rourke's position. The instructions to Lieutenant St. James were simple. Advance in a long skirmish line, making a lot of noise, forcing the quarry to either move back the way they came or take a defensive position. Either way, their backs would be turned to Rourke, Paul Rubinstein, and Darkwood. Darkwood crossing the clearing more or less openly was insurance. Unless the elite corpsmen were imbeciles, they'd be watching their backs and spot Darkwood. Rourke began moving again, slowly, silently, drawing the Life Support System 10 from its sheath at his side. He held the knife with his gloved hand in a rapier hold as he moved through the snow. Jason Darkwood's palms sweated inside his heavy gloves. He did the thing every midshipman learned not to do, volunteer. He was the best man for the job because he was the least experienced in surface warfare, a novice compared to veterans like Rourke and Rubinstein.
Rubinstein's an interesting guy. Talk about truth to the old expression of not judging a book by its cover.
Paul Rubinstein wasn't short, but he wasn't exactly tall either. His hair was thinning badly. He didn't seem overtly muscular. Darkwood stopped beside a tall tree with snow on its bark. Snow fascinated him, the very look of it, its taste on the tongue. Jason realized this experience was something everyone at Midwake missed, most without realizing it. For 5 centuries, the people of Midwake lived beneath the sea in a domed complex. They traveled within the city, or, for people like him, working in part of Midwake's defense forces, traveled by submarine. Everywhere they went, in every mode of transportation, they traveled within a controlled environment, generation after generation. But now, with Midwake's unavoidable involvement in the surface war against the Russians of the underground city in the Ural Mountains, their isolation would end. In one respect, that was good. The stringent voluntary population control, with the help of 5 centuries of war casualties that kept Midwake numbers manageable, would someday, perhaps soon, be unnecessary. There was an entire world to populate, to know, to experience.
If I live, I'm going to be part of that. Travel unexplored seas, step onto the shores they kiss.
Jason resumed walking, the M16 he took from the hands of a dead Eden-based defender still unfamiliar to his hands. Darkwood compromised. He shifted the assault rifle into his left hand and drew the Midwake issue pistol. Jason knew what a 9mm Lancer caseless would do to an enemy from first-hand experience, the M16 only through observation. The 2418A2 had a solid feel to it, largely psychological, he knew, but much of warfare, much of survival, was psychological. Somewhere in the woods on either side of the clearing he skirted, Dr. Rourke and Mr. Rubinstein were closing on the enemy. If Jason couldn't tell exactly where they were, did that mean the enemy couldn't either?
The enemy.
For 5 centuries, the people of Midwake fought the forces of the Soviet underwater complex that shared, ironically, the same undersea volcanic vent as their lone source of geothermal energy. There were some in Midwake who blamed Dr. Rourke for involving Midwake in the war on the land against these new Soviet enemies. But they were the uninformed, who let one too many drinks do the talking for them, or were mindless to begin with. Now that the Soviet Navy had nuclear missile capabilities, a broadening of the 5 centuries-long war was inevitable. There was no danger of direct nuclear attack on Midwake, but Soviet island-class submarines armed with nuclear missiles could have destroyed the Midwake fleet, leaving Midwake powerless to resist Soviet invasion. Flooding Midwake was a popular topic among some of the very old. Once, when the Soviet Marine Spetsnaz attacked Midwake in force, better than 70 years ago, it was said that when all seemed lost, when it seemed the people of Midwake were close to extinction, the government was on the verge of collapsing the domes under the pressure of the sea around them.
Well, it was inevitable.
Darkwood reached the midway point of the clearing. If someone was going to start shooting at him, it would be soon. He tightened his gloved fist on the butt of the 2418A2.
God, what was I thinking? I should be back on the Reagan.
John Rourke stood stock still. He saw movement at about 11 o'clock on the far side of the clearing. Paul might have seen it, but that was doubtful from Paul's vantage point on the opposite side, coming up counterclockwise from the 6 o'clock position. Rourke couldn't wait for a gunshot because Darkwood was risking his neck enough. One shot or a full automatic burst could be the end of the man, and Darkwood was a good man. Rourke dropped into a crouch, moving forward quickly, the LX-10 still in the rapier hold. He saw more movement, perhaps 50 yards off, as snow dislodged and fell to the ground. Rourke moved laterally, deeper into the trees, as he increased the distance between himself and whoever moved ahead of him. He rose to his full height and quickened his pace. Once again, he spotted motion ahead and to the left of him, from the same spot where he first saw it. From his new position, he could see a man, roughly his own height, in the black battle uniform of the KGB Elite Corps, raising an assault rifle to his shoulder, just ready to snap off a burst.
Oh, you're not pulling that trigger today.
John ran across the snow, the crane knife in his right fist. The man with the assault rifle turned. Rourke hurtled into the Soviet. In the same motion, he clapped his hand over the man's mouth and arced his knife into the corpsman's belly, primary edge up. Rourke tore the knife up from the navel to sternum. The man's body went rigid, then suddenly limp. Rourke was on his feet, wiping the blade of his knife clean against the soldier's BDU. He heard movement 75 or 100 yards deeper into the woods, saw snow crashing down from a low-hanging bough on the far side of the clearing at approximately 2 o'clock. Paul. Rourke broke left into a long-strided run. He caught more movement out of the corner of his eye. Amidst the trees, he saw a splotch of black uniform against a drift of white snow. Rourke was even with them now. He turned and ran toward them from their right flank.
Paul! Darkwood! Over here!
John sheathed his knife and grabbed the two scoremasters.
John! The rest of you, close in from that side. You and you and you follow me.
Take the left flank. You and you and you two. Follow me, the rest of you.
There was movement running through the trees, and a burst of automatic weapons fire lit the darkness.
Don't let it be these.
An aggregate of rocks opened to the far and near sides, affording protection from the direction of the clearing and the direction from which Lieutenant Lily St. James's platoon of Marines would be coming, but no protection from John Rourke. Rourke saw one of the Soviets turn. Rourke dodged right and back as the scoremaster in his right hand raised to shoulder height, his right first finger squeezed. Snow churned up before him as the scoremaster rocked gently in his right fist. He averted his eyes as the snow sprayed toward him. Rourke caught a glimpse of a body going down as he raised his left hand to shoulder height and let go a single shot to the head of the elite corpsman nearest the female captive. Assault rifle fire tore into the tree trunks beside Rourke. Rourke fired both pistols from shoulder height. Rourke drove left, hit the snow, and rolled away from a fresh burst of assault rifle fire.
Stay down, John!
John listened to the rattle of Paul's submachine gun, firing neat three-round bursts, textbook perfect. The last man swung his rifle toward the woman. Gunfire poured in on the target from three directions. Rourke looked to his right. Darkwood, pistol in hand, stood there.
It's Dr. Rourke, Miss Zeiss. Are you all right?
Rourke, Darkwood beside him, moved out. Paul circled to the far side, so if anyone were still alive and dangerous, they'd have him in a crossfire. Maritza Zeiss stumbled out of the rocks, the gleam of blood on her right cheek, possibly hers or perhaps from the rupturing of a gunshot wound near her. She fell to her knees. Rourke nodded to Darkwood, who went to his knees beside her, taking her into his arms. John scanned the bodies as Paul approached through the frozen snow.
Natalia?
Natalia Anastasia Tyomarovna heard Annie's voice. She opened her eyes, but the bright light made her close them again.
How are you feeling?
Natalia turned her head away. A flood of memories filled her thoughts. It was a confusing jumble with no clear boundary between what truly happened and what might be fantasy. Knights in armor, helicopter pursuits, Michael about to be killed, John's knife in her hands, and Vladimir's head.
Where am I?
She felt silly as she said it, and her voice sounded oddly dry, disused, and unfamiliar to her. Natalia turned her head back and opened her eyes, gradually this time.
You've been very sick, Natalia. But you're better now. You're in the hospital, at Midwake. A lot of things happened, but everybody's fine. My mom and dad, Paul, Michael, Otto, everybody. Now that you're better, well, things will be just great. There's an alliance, and we're going to turn things around. I just know it.
Natalia ran her hands back through her hair. Her hair felt just washed, just arranged.
You have such pretty hair. I hope I fixed it right.
I remember something. You were...
It was the only way to make you better, to find out what was wrong. I figured, well, that you would have done anything to help me, so...
Annie looked down at her hands folded in her lap. Natalia watched her for a moment, recalling how John used to call Annie's hair honey blonde. It was darker now, but so very beautiful.
Annie... You are my best friend.
Annie moved to the edge of the bed, folding Natalia into her arms, touching her lips to Natalia's forehead. Natalia rested her head against Annie's shoulder. John and Sarah Rourke stood beside the table. Sarah's face looked a little pale, Darkwood thought, compared to the rest of the surface people around. On reflection, it had to have been a terrible experience for her, killing that man a split second before the man would have murdered the Japanese naval lieutenant. Darkwood stripped off his gloves and opened his coat.
I'm so happy it's nothing serious, Maritza. When they radioed back that they'd found you and you were all right, oh, everyone was so happy.
Your husband was so brave, Frau.
I just thought I'd check in, leaving you in good hands.
He nodded toward Darkwood, shot Maritza a smile, and ushered his wife toward a still open panel on the far wall. They disappeared. It was a little cold in the tent, despite the heater units working to capacity and the plastic-like material patched over most of the holes ripped in the tent walls by shrapnel and debris during the Battle for Eden. Maritza was stripped to rather male-looking underwear, something like an athletic shirt and panties, more the size of shorts, and there was a blanket wrapped around her shoulders. Even so, Jason Darkwood couldn't help thinking she was really beautiful. He realized he was staring at her, turned away, found a table edge to perch on, and found himself staring at her again. Maritza Zeiss cleaned up very nicely. The examining German doctor found her badly shaken by her ordeal, but physically unharmed, beyond a few bruises and the beginnings of frostbite on the tips of the toes of her right foot. She sat on the edge of an examining table as a nurse did something to the little toe.
So you command a submarine? Wow.
You're German, I know, but you sound very American. Did Germans from 500 years ago all speak English so well?
Oh.
The nurse daubed something on the toe.
I went to college in the United States, then came back here for my doctorate.
Darkwood realized he was staring at her, smiling at her. She was very pretty, reddish blonde hair, the hint of freckles on her shoulders where the blanket fell away, a long and slender neck, and a nice figure.
Right, Jason. You want to get our relationship going again? Huh, I bet.
He shrugged his shoulders to turn off his conscience, perhaps.
What did you earn your PhD in?
Agriculture. Why are you laughing?
Maritza smiled, pouting her lip a little.
Well, you're the first 500-year-old farmer I've ever met. I didn't realize farmers were so pretty.
She started to say something. Then her jaw literally dropped. Darkwood started to his feet toward her, then saw her eyes. She was staring at something behind him. He turned around. One of the volunteers had dropped a tray of instruments, and as the woman bent over, her hand or something must have caught on the sheet covering the gurney behind her. The sheet fell away to reveal a dead body. The face was laced with blue veins under gray skin. Darkwood saw the body before, when he, John Rourke, and Paul Rubinstein returned to Eden Base. The body lay on the ground then, like so many others. But the commander of the forces from New Germany, Colonel Wolfgang Mann, and the Eden Project commander, Christopher Dodd, were standing near it, arguing over something. Sarah Rourke was sitting on the ground beside the wall, staring at the body, an empty pistol in her lap. It was the body of the Nazi, Damien Rausch, the man that Sarah Rourke shot to death there at the wall. Maybe the body was about to be autopsied or something. Darkwood assumed Maritza was shocked at the sight of still another casualty, regardless of who it was. He turned around, intending to say something comforting.
That is the man I saw with Commander Dodd. Poor man. Commander Dodd said he was an agent working for Colonel Mann. He probably died very bravely.
Jason Darkwood looked at her.
His was a unique death, I understand. Yes.
Jason looked back at the ashen countenance as the nurse finished collecting the instruments, then threw the plastic sheet back over the dead man's face.
Very unique.
John Rourke stood just inside the hermetic flap of the tent. Snow was already dripping off the shoulders of his parka.
Dr. Rourke, please have a seat.
Standing is fine. Apparently, Maritza Z saw you talking to Damien Rausch. When she asked you about him, you told her he was an agent of Colonel Mann's.
Rourke watched Commander Christopher Dodd in the light from the overhead lamp.
What? That's preposterous. Let her say that to my face. I'd like to confront her. That's what I'd like to do.
Dodd slammed his open palm down on the folding camp table. He was an unconvincing actor.
This Zeiss woman must have had more of a shock from her kidnapping than anyone suspected. If she can say what she said to your precious Captain Darkwood to my face, I'll step down as Eden Base Commander, Dr. Rourke. I know that makes certain elements here, like Kuranami, Halverson, yourself, and your family exceedingly happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right there.
John Rourke looked at the man.
If she is incorrect, I'll owe you an apology for even mentioning this.
Dodd's eyes narrowed, and he stood up from behind the table.
If she's correct, Doctor, I'd be a traitor, wouldn't I? So if I had anything to hide, why the hell would I want to confront her in the first place? Answer me that if you can. Think about it, man. Just because some of my decisions around here are unpopular, everybody wants to see me get tossed in the trash pile. Well, I'm sick of it. I'll confront her, all right. She's either lying or crazy. That man, what was his name?
Damien Rausch.
Roush, yes. That man may have been drifting in and out of camp here. For all I know, he could have been wearing a German uniform. Most of those...
They all look alike.
That's not what I meant, damn it.
She's in her tent, Dr. Zeiss, that is. Why don't we walk over there and see her? Under the circumstances, considering her ordeal, I think it'd be the polite thing.
Dodd looked at the watch on his wrist, hesitated, then nodded.
All right, I'll go with you. Let me get my coat.
John Rourke only nodded. Paul looked like a snowman. He hadn't wanted to enter Dodd's tent, so stood outside under the canopy shelter. But the wind blew quite strongly and the snow fell heavily. The result? Paul's parka was covered. He patted his sleeves to get rid of some of the snow as they walked, the three of them abreast. Paul to Rourke's right, Dodd to Rourke's left. Brushing away the snow was a useless gesture, Rourke thought, because already his own parka was all but covered, as was Dodd's, and Paul's was recovering. They walked across the camp in silence, Paul still brushing away snow. Maritza Zisa's tent, which she shared with five other women, was on the far side of the base, near the north perimeter. Though much was destroyed there, the tent stood fast. German troops and Eden-based personnel moved about the area near the prefabricated perimeter wall, repairing it. There was no way to tell when the Russians might strike again, although logic, substantiated by German high-altitude electronic intelligence, dictated it wouldn't be soon. There weren't enough gunships in any one place to indicate that they were massing for an attack.
Is that her tent? I hope so, I'm freezing.
Rourke looked at him and said nothing. They stopped at the tent. Rourke glanced over the ground. He thought he saw footprints, seeming to come from inside the tent, but the wind drove the snow so strongly he couldn't be sure. Paul looked at him. Rourke nodded. Paul took his gloved right hand from the muff pocket and rapped on the tent pole beside the sealed door.
Dr. Zeiss! It's us! John Rourke and Paul Rubenstein! We have Dodd with us!
Rourke looked at the sealed flap, then dropped to one knee before it. Tugging off his right outer glove, he drew his first finger through the nearly filled depression in the snow, the depression that could have been a boot print.
Try again, Paul.
Dr. Zeiss! Captain Darkwood!
Well, evidently, she's out.
Rourke looked up, then stood, dusting snow from his inner glove.
Probably ducked out for a pizza.
John reached to open the tent flap.
We're coming inside!
He turned to Paul.
Watch out.
As Rourke pulled open the flap with his left hand, his right hand found the butt of one of the scoremasters in his belt beneath his coat. He thumbed back the hammer, then swept up the ambidextrous safety. With his thumb poised over the safety and his right first finger just inside the trigger guard but not touching the trigger, Rourke stepped through into the weatherlock, his left hand working the interior flap. Paul, just behind him, nudged Commander Dodd.
Pull that closed after you, huh?
Rourke drew open the interior flap. It was dark inside the tent, only a dull glow of gray daylight lighting the tent walls, but providing no illumination for the interior. Rourke held the German flashlight in his left hand, his wrists locked together, right over left, the beam of the flashlight and the muzzle of the handgun pointing in the same direction.
Darkwood?
To your right.
Rourke swung the beam from his flashlight and the gun simultaneously. The light swept toward one of the cots. On the cot lay the partially clad body of a woman, Maritza Zeiss, her throat slit ear to ear, eyes wide open, very little blood across her chest and naked breasts. Lying beside her, half on the cot, half off, coat off, pants pulled down to the ankles, lay Jason Darkwood.
Paul, check the rest of the tent. Dodd, stay with him.
I'm going
You're doing just what I say, unless you want to get planted right on your ass.
Rourke crossed the tent and dropped to his knees beside Darkwood. There was a dark bruise at the base of Darkwood's skull, just at the hairline. John felt for a pulse. It was there, a little weak, but he'd felt weaker ones. Breathing was shallow but regular. Darkwood needed treatment quickly, but a few seconds under the circumstances wouldn't make that much difference. Rourke stood, took several steps back, then gradually began moving the flashlight over the two bodies, almost an inch at a time, trying to photograph the scene in his mind. There was a small cut, the blood flow almost negligible, at the left corner of Maritza's mouth by the lower lip. A red mark was faintly visible on the left side of her throat, noticeable only because her hair was back, across the pillow, almost arranged that way. The red mark appeared to be some sort of abrasion. The wound itself was a thin line across her throat, either from a very sharp knife or something like a straight razor. Her left nipple was partially torn, but there was no blood visible.
Paul.
John?
Go over by the bodies and exhale several times, then get as close as you can or you're comfortable with and tell me what you smell.
The younger man nodded grimly. Rourke drew back toward the tent seal.
Either semen or bleach. Ugh.
Paul stood up as John Rourke approached the cot again. He shot the flashlight around the tent interior.
Paul, grab me the pillowcase off that inflatable pillow.
Right.
Paul took the pillow off the cot, stripped the pillowcase from it, and handed it to John. Rourke set down his pistol and flashlight. By the light from Paul's flashlight, he placed his still-gloved hand inside the pillowcase. He wrapped the pillowcase around his hand several times. Slowly, he slid his hand between Darkwood's body and the edge of the cot. Rourke's swathed hand moved over Darkwood's naked abdomen, across the hair at Darkwood's crotch. He withdrew his hand and held up the pillowcase.
Now, Paul, sniff it. I'm sorry. I'd do it myself, but I had a cigar a little bit ago.
I don't have to watch.
I agree. Why don't you close your eyes?
I don't smell it.
Rourke moved his hand back. This time, he swabbed Darkwood's inner thighs. Again, he held up the pillowcase.
Nope, I don't smell it.
Rourke brought the pillowcase once more under Darkwood's body, this time swabbing along the shaft of the penis and into the area on either side of the testicles. Even with the cigar, the semen smell was easily detectable.
You smell it now?
Oh, yeah!
Give me the pillow you took this off.
The younger man handed him the plastic inflatable pillow. Rourke carefully folded the pillowcase to keep the material with the semen sample inside. Now he placed the pillow between Darkwood's genitalia and the edge of the cot, moving the pillow across the penis. When he withdrew the transparent plastic pillow, there were small whitish streaks on its surface.
Keep an eye on that.
All right.
Rourke took up his flashlight again. He searched along the floor. Beside Darkwood's blood-smeared right hand was a midwake-issue bayonet. It was blood-smeared, too, very likely the murder weapon, regardless of who wielded it. Also on the floor, as if it had fallen from her partially open hand just above it, was a triple D-cell rechargeable flashlight. Rourke wasn't concerned about fingerprints.
Get me another pillowcase. Rip this one in half or something so it's easily identifiable.
Right. Hey, what are you gonna do?
What I have to do.
Wrapping the pillowcase around his hand, he used it to take a semen specimen from the dead woman's genitalia.
All right. Keep an eye on this one, too. We'll get the two specimens typed. Odds are they match. Then we'll check that against Darkwood after he provides us with a sample. If Darkwood's sample doesn't match...
Hey, just a damn minute, Rourke. Just because this man is a friend of yours, you're denying obvious evidence of a rape and murder?
John Rourke looked over his shoulder at Commander Dodd.
You know, I'm having a hard day. Don't push.
It was like giving a urine specimen, only worse. Darkwood's head ached, his neck ached, and when he moved his head, his entire body was seized with pain and stiffness. In the end, Jason Darkwood mentally reconstructed an evening more than a year before that he spent with Maggie Barrow. When he was done, and he felt drained for a moment, there was no sensation of the pain for a few seconds, but when the pain returned, it was more violent than before. He leaned back in the hospital bed, his face feeling hot, but he took care of the thing. It wasn't that he hadn't been very tempted with Maritza. Had she lived, well, he didn't know. Now he never would. He pushed the nurse call button. The curtain around his bed parted, and a German med tech, a young man of about 20, entered the cubicle.
You're finished here, Captain Darkwood?
Jason Darkwood didn't quite know what to say, but nodded. The prophylactic closed at the open end with a rubber band and inside a small beaker of tepid water. It floated around like a communications buoy.
Here. Dr. Rourke would wish to speak with you here, Captain.
Yeah, sure.
Darkwood nodded. He shouldn't have nodded.
Oh.
The German medtech disappeared. Darkwood tried to find a comfortable position on the pillow for his head. There was a knock on one of the support posts for the curtain.
Come in.
The curtains parted and John Rourke stepped in.
Oh, Dr. Rourke.
Don't stand up, Jason. How you feeling?
Rourke stepped to the bed.
In no special order of importance? Well, stupid. Embarrassed. Like I'm up Schitt's Creek. Is that a real place? And in a lot of pain.
I couldn't give you anything really strong because of what you had to do. It's quite important that we have that sample right away. Now, what happened?
Jason Darkwood shifted position, and his head ached all the more, so he fidgeted back.
Okay, I took her back to her tent, like we agreed. I thought she was attractive, and maybe I would have tried something with her, but not that way. What's she saying, anyway? I mean, I figured out why you wanted the test.
John pulled the solitary folding chair around and straddled it as he sat down.
No one's told you then. She's dead.
Jason Darkwood felt his eyes open wide, and the headache worsened instantly.
What? Oh, what? She's... Now, wait a minute.
What do you remember?
Darkwood closed his eyes against the pain, and he thought maybe it would help him to remember. He remembered waking up in the hospital bed. He was told he'd been hurt and that it was urgent that he give a sample of ejaculant. He remembered things very fuzzily before that.
I can't tell you.
Can't?
I don't remember. I took her to the tent, and we went inside, and bang! I don't have any idea. Oh, God. What happened to my head?
What do you mean, bang?
Darkwood shook his head, the pain consuming him.
We went inside, and I don't remember anything after that. Oh, my God.
Now, what did you mean earlier when you assumed you suspected the reason we needed an ejaculant sample?
I assumed something happened, and she said I did something to her. Oh, God. What would you think of if you woke up and your head felt 10 times too big and somebody wanted you to jerk off and...
Were you thinking about her sexually? I mean, why you took her to her tent?
Oh, I don't know. I was thinking I was cold. What the hell's going on? What do you mean she's dead? I'm a little slow today,
Someone
but...
Someone murdered Maritza Zeese, and then went to a great deal of trouble to make it appear you raped her. The way...
What? Oh, God.
Darkwood sat upright, and his head felt as if it would explode. He blinked his eyes against the pain.
The scene, as it appeared, was that you fought with her, raped her, and her mouth was bleeding, one of her nipples was partially torn off.
Oh, God. Doctor!
Then, as it was supposed to appear, you slit her throat with a midwake-issue fighting knife.
I don't even carry one of those.
I know that you carry a duplicate of a Randall Smithsonian Bowie. Paul knows that, too, as, of course, do your men. The killer, or whoever put him up to it, didn't. Just as you raked the knife across her throat, with her last ounce of strength, she made a valiant effort to kill you, hitting you at the base of the skull with the butt of her flashlight. Evidently, you were supposed to be dead, too. Now, either the killer was in a hurry, or he was too stupid or too incompetent to tell that you were alive. Your pulse was weak and your breathing was shallow. I tend to think he was in a hurry, which would correspond with another observation, one I made before we came on the scene. There was ejaculate on your...
Oh, shit. Oh, God.
The pain in Darkwood's head grew so intense he almost didn't care.
I had the Germans tested. It matches what was found in her vaginal area. The only way to prove your innocence is to compare that to the specimen you just provided us. Unless the killer's your identical twin brother, it won't match. I know you didn't do it, and you know you didn't do it. Professor Zeese was popular to begin with, a lovely, talented woman and someone the Eden personnel were counting on a great deal once the weather moderated enough to try crops. That's why you're in the German field hospital, not the one staffed by Eden personnel. There was an attempt at mob justice here once before, under surprisingly similar circumstances, when Natalia was suspected of aiding the Soviets. I didn't want to see history repeat itself.
What about Sam Aldridge and Lily St. James and the rest of the Midwake personnel?
Well, you mean, do they know about this? Yeah, I put them on alert, just in case. Whoever our killer was eliminated Dr. Zeese and tried to eliminate you and at the same time discredit the Midwake Officer Corps.
Oh, this'll have to be...
Darkwood's tongue felt thick, the pain intense.
Reported? I'm your CEO, remember? Brigadier General Rourke? Once the lab tests are back, there won't be any charges brought. Nothing will go on your record. Your president and your admiral want me to cooperate? Well, they can cooperate with me then. There's a more serious concern than you.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, well, I thought you would be, Jason. No, there's a murderer loose, and he's working in complicity with Commander Dodd.
What?
He moved, and he shouldn't have.
Oh, God, I shouldn't have...
That's another reason I wanted you here. I didn't want a mysterious embolism popping up or something. Now, rest.
Doctor,
John Rourke reached under his sweater, glanced toward the curtains, then turned the palm of his hand toward Darkwood. In his hand was Darkwood's own 24-18-82.
I can't put it under the pillow. I disrupt hospital routine, and, anyway, Gunzer, damned uncomfortable to sleep on. So roll over a little if you can.
Darkwood rolled over right, felt the mattress lift slightly, then lower.
Where did I...
The mattress and the cot frame. If you need it, you'll have to get out of bed for it. I'm sorry about that. But on the plus side, it's chamber loaded and ready to go. Remind me to see if I can find you a 45. You'll like it better, trust me.
Rourke smiled, then walked out between the curtains. Jason Darkwood lay back. The curtains opened once more. It was Dr. Rourke again.
Trust this med tech. He's one of Colonel Mann's people. He's got an injection for you. Painkiller. Make you sleep. By the time you wake up, everything should be worked out. Rest well.
The curtains closed, and Dr. Rourke vanished. The med tech stepped through the curtains and approached the bed. It was the same man who took the sample from him.
It would be better, Herr Captain, to administer this injection in your buttocks.
Just what I needed.
There were only three still standing modules in what had been the German headquarters complex at their facility outside Eden Base. John asked that the samples be flown there because Dr. Munchen, the German physician both Sarah and John counted a friend, still had laboratory facilities there, however rudimentary. Sarah's eyes narrowed. John looked through the powerful electronically enhanced microscope. Sarah had just looked through it at two specimens and saw nothing different between them, and that worried her. Jason Darkwood seemed like such a very good man. John looked.
We've got a match.
Oh, no.
Oh, relax. These are the separate samples I took from Jason Darkwood's genitalia and from Maritza Zeiss.
Well, now what?
Dr. Munchen smiled cheerfully.
Now, Frau Rourke, you can see for yourself that the sample taken from Jason Darkwood does not, in fact, match either of these.
Sarah stepped across the room to the microscope, fingers on the adjustment knobs.
I don't see a difference.
Touch the button at your left, Frau Rourke.
She touched the button, and suddenly she saw. The slides were diffused with purple light.
Semen identification techniques have changed little over the centuries, I think. Your husband kindly lent me several books dealing with forensic science. The main difference is the instrumentation with which we are able to examine. A combination of acid phosphatase and ultraviolet light gives us the answers. As you should be able to see, there are subtle differences in the spermatozoa. Fortunate for us, it was so cold that the samples taken from the body of the woman and from the American Captain Jason Darkwood were still viable.
There were subtle differences in shapes, subtle but clearly different. Sarah looked up from the microscope.
Then this is conclusive proof.
In two ways. Whoever semen this matches is the killer, almost certainly. Unless there were two men, one who did the murder and one who raped her afterward.
Sarah looked at him.
Afterward?
John nodded.
The torn nipple. There was no bleeding, which meant, of course, that circulation had stopped. Conclusive evidence, of course, that Dr. Zeiss was already dead. We have not only a murderer to deal with, but a necrophile as well.
Oh, a necrophile. Someone having intercourse with the dead. Oh.
John's next words made her want to throw up.
Records taken from the leader's private files in New Germany indicate that Friedrich Rausch was into necrophilia. Don't ask for the details. And he's the man whose brother you shot to death, Sarah. He'll be after you.
Oh, no.
John folded her into his arms. Christopher Dodd was freezing. He kept walking for two reasons. He had to see Rausch's brother, and if he stopped walking, he might freeze to death. The sling of the M16 over his shoulder rattled. It was the only sound amid the silence of the still-increasing snowfall beyond his own rather labored breathing. He brought the rifle in case some of the KGB people who escaped the battle took refuge here in the partially constructed permanent base. It had been checked, but what if the Russians doubled back? He reached the foundation and partially erected walls of the community center. Snow drifted high as a man's waist in some areas. The construction equipment, much of it undamaged despite the attack, sat all but covered in snow.
You may stop there, Commander.
Dodd stopped in mid-stride. The late Damien Rausch was insane, but there was a certain civility about him, a certain pleasantness when he spoke. Friedrich Rausch shared his brother's insanity, but it was a ruthless brand with none of the veneer of civility.
May I turn around?
You are armed, Commander.
Yes, I thought there might be Russians about.
There were three. Trust me, you are safe now.
Dodd slowly started to turn, and as he did, he saw something red partially covered by a snowdrift in a corner made by two unfinished walls. It was a body, or at least part of one. Sarah lay in their cot and watched John as he cleaned his guns. Sarah Rourke watched her husband cleaning his little .45s more times than she could remember, but there was something especially meticulous about the way he did it tonight. She watched him until he was finished. He closed the lubricant, it had a nice enough smell, and walked over to the cot. He placed both pistols on the chair beside his side of the cot.
I'll have to wash my hands.
Sarah Rourke wondered if that meant he wanted to make love to her. She wanted him to, but her thoughts were still filled with images of Damien Rausch and the body of Maritza Zeiss. She didn't know if she could get those thoughts out of her mind and her heart. Jason Darkwood, in a bathrobe and combat boots, a sweater around his shoulders, sat in the chair beside his bed. His face looked pale, small lines creased around his eyes from pain. His eyes looked slightly glassy from the medication. Rourke knew what Darkwood was taking, knew that it would not otherwise dull Darkwood's perceptions. The others in the curtained cubicle were Paul, Michael, Sam Aldridge, Wolfgang Mann, and Dr. Munchen. Colonel Mann ordered this segment of the complex of tents comprising the field hospital cleared of all but those patients who were sedated. His commandos were posted around the tent.
We have a very serious problem. Now, in some respects, it's more my problem and Michael's and Paul's than anyone else's. But in some ways, it's a problem for the German command and the Midway Officer Corps. Contrary to the news we released last night, the semen test results were positive, not inconclusive.
Huh?
We know that Captain Darkwood is innocent. Granted, we had no doubt of that from the first, those of us who know him, but now there's conclusive proof, the sort of thing that would stand up in a court of law if need be. Now, I'm gratified no one bothered to ask why we let out erroneous information. Frankly, the answer is obvious. As long as Jason Darkwood is considered too weak to provide another sample at this time, the medication for his concussion has induced temporary impotence.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Shit!
Sam Aldridge tried to stifle a laugh.
If Captain Darkwood were killed before another sample could be arranged for, Commander Dodd would be in the clear. Crime of passion responsible for the death of the only person who could have conclusively linked Dodd with Damien Rausch, the Nazi conspirator. If murder by a third party is proven, Dodd could be implicated. It would certainly, has certainly, put Commander Dodd under a cloud. Consequently, the real murderer, if we can make things attractive enough for him, will try to rectify his oversight. When the blow is struck to Captain Darkwood's neck, as Dr. Munchen and I agree, evidently the reaction time...
Rourke looked at Darkwood.
Your reaction time was very good. You saved your life without knowing it. When you realized you were being struck, in that split second you ducked just enough that the blow delivered to you wasn't strong enough to kill. Our killer was very confident, so confident that he never thoroughly checked that you were dead. What we want is for him to attempt to rectify that situation by trying to kill you, Jason.
Sure, why not?
Jason nodded again, his eyes showing the strain of his pain.
Dr. Munchen will arrange for certain patients to be transferred to the still-standing portions of the hospital at the German base. Jason will be one of the patients, transferred there for extensive recuperation. The other patients, as it were, will be midweight personnel under the command of Captain Aldridge and some of Colonel Mann's personal commando force. The chief physician will be Dr. Munchen, but the rest of his staff will be midweight and German personnel. Now, if we're lucky, the secret will remain a secret, and Friedrich Rausch will go for the bait. And then we kill him. Let me reiterate that, gentlemen, since he will be coming for my wife if he remains alive. We kill him.
Sam Aldridge nodded.
Amen to that, Dr. Rourke.
We can't have the place looking more guarded than it should be. I understand that the hurricane in the Gulf is still blowing and reinforcements will be further delayed. In this case, that's to our advantage. We'll have to leave enough people at Eden Base to protect it. That means that proportionately fewer personnel will be available to guard the hospital at what remains of the German base. That makes Friedrich Rausch's chances all the better for success, all the more inviting.
Where's Mrs. Rourke, Doctor?
For now, she's under guard by some of Colonel Mann's people, Sam. When this goes down, she'll be far away from here and very safe. You can trust that.
And, what about Dodd?
Jason Darkwood sounded as tired as he looked.
Unless we take Rausch alive on the assumption that he'll talk,
which he wouldn't do voluntarily, and we might not be able to get him to do with the drugs. There'll likely be no way of making a firm connection between Commander Dodd, the brothers Rausch, and the neo-Nazi movement in New Germany. So the answer to the obvious question is, no, we won't be able to do anything about Dodd. Dodd's gonna have to make a bigger mistake than this. Eden's repopulation for Earth is based on the same system in place at Midwake and since the overthrow of the leader in New Germany. In a democratic republic, under a system of laws where innocence is presumed until otherwise proven, we don't have a shred of evidence beyond the circumstantial. The only way to rid ourselves of Commander Dodd would be to depose him illegally. Now, I don't think we have the right to do that. We can keep pressuring him to hold free elections, but not until the war footing here is eased a bit. If Eden were to hold free elections today, Akira Kuranami would undoubtedly be elected president.
Well, not to be a wet blanket, Doctor, but Georgia is United States territory. Those space shuttles are United States aircraft. For the past 5 centuries, the government of Midwake has been the government of the United States.
John Rourke shook his head.
Well, you're right, of course, in theory. But the personnel here are not representatives of the United States. They're representatives of every NATO, CETO, and OAS nation. Almost every free nation on Earth that ascribed to the same principles as the United States prior to the night of the war. This is an international community. The government established here won't be a new United States. Now granted, Eden Base is on what was once and may still legally be U.S. soil. That'll be something for the government seated at Midway to work out with Eden Base, but only after Eden Base has a government to negotiate with.
Back to the subject of Herr Rausch. Should Friedrich Rausch not be apprehended, there is nowhere on Earth where Frau Rourke would be safe. I would offer sanctuary in New Germany, but the death of my own wife proved to me that if the Nazis wish to kill someone in New Germany, for the time being at least, they can do so. And the forces of law and government are powerless to stop them. Certainly the assassin might be apprehended, but not until his deed is done. What will happen, Doctor, should Rausch not make an attempt on the life of Captain Darkwood? Or for that matter, should Rausch make such an attempt and make good his escape as well?
She'll be safe, Colonel.
Until...
Rourke looked at him and smiled.
She'll be safe until Rausch is no longer a threat. I realize the retreat was discovered by Rausch's brother, penetrated by taking advantage of Kuranami and because of superior numbers. But when Rausch's brother Damien died, he was the last of the men to have reached the retreat. The secret died with him. Aside from a group of people I trust implicitly, the location of and means of entry to the retreat remains a secret. Sarah will be there, but not alone. I've taken steps that as soon as Major Tiemnarovna is well enough to travel from Midwake, both she and my daughter, Paul's wife, will join Sarah at the retreat. All right. We're coming down to it, to an end to this war, one way or the other. The women have endured enough danger. No more.